This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Rebecca Hanscom of Teamsters Local 738 spoke recently in Chicago at a forum on Iraq regarding the impact of the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, and the possibility of war and its impact on unions, civil liberties, and organized labor.
Consequences of the war on Iraq is that it provides the current conservative administration with a new way to press its agenda in favor of big business and against the interests of working people in America. This anti-labor agenda can be seen in both external actions against unions and in the internal consequences of those actions. The anti-labor agenda attacks our right to organize, our right to negotiate, and our right even to exist. Let's look first at the external consequences of the war on Iraq. I'm going to discuss briefly three examples. Example one is the use of Taft-Hartley legislation. President Bush's use of Taft-Hartley in the longshoreman lockout, not strike, lockout on the West Coast mirrors President Reagan's use of striker replacement legislation in 1981. We all know the result of President Reagan's actions, a green light to bosses and anti-worker attorneys to engage in a union-busting war. The numbers of unionized workers began to plummet after Reagan's actions against the air traffic controllers. Taft-Hartley poses an equally great threat in that the law provides the administration with the power of injunction rather than negotiation over work stoppages. Bush sought to justify his Taft-Hartley actions against over 10,000 longshoremen in part because of war plans in Iraq and security issues at home. And this doesn't just apply to longshoremen on the West Coast. Business and Bush are already in discussions about how Taft-Hartley can be used against the auto workers next year. About 500,000 auto workers are covered by contracts which will expire in the year 2003. And the ripple effect among steel workers, Teamsters, and other industrial and transportation unions will be devastating. A second example of the collateral damage to labor of a war in Iraq is a direct loss of union membership. The most immediate result of the Homeland Security bill just passed by our government is to effectively eliminate the rights of 177,000 workers to a union. Protective service workers currently have the highest unionization rate among all occupations at 38%. These jobs are under the attack of privatization. President Bush also announced that he intends to contract out 850,000 federal government jobs. This act would tear the heart out of our government unions. Of our current union density, government workers have a unionization rate 4 times higher than in the private sector. This decimation of the public sector will damage even further the ability of all unions to get decent contracts. In addition to contracting out federal jobs, the Bush administration is targeting civil service regulations. Civil service and unions have historically been the primary paths that women and minorities followed to achieve good jobs that are secure. There is definitely a racist edge to the administration's choice of job targets, as well as an anti-union edge. A third example of the attack on working people is that times of war increase the president's ability to shift budget priorities. The president is currently pursuing budget shifts to the defense industry and homeland security while doing everything he can to make sure that these are not union jobs. Manufacturing, transportation, education, and health and social services will suffer in these budget shifts unless we act now to protect them. This will mean further loss of union job protections. As frightening as are the external hazards to labor unions, are the internal dangers to union activism. The war on terrorism, the war on Iraq, will have a chilling effect on union activism. The U.S. Patriot Act and the Department of Justice have lowered the thresholds of evidence required to authorize secret wiretaps and surveillance. The Justice Department is planning to double the number of FBI agents in the National Security Law Unit. The department is creating an electronic system that will allow field agents to draft and submit surveillance applications instantly as part of President Bush's push for blanket war powers. This will have a freezing effect on the union right to organize. How many union members, or better yet, unorganized members, do you think will rally outside of a Walmart in the streets of Chicago against unfettered globalization or on a picket line when they know they are being videotaped and that their faces and personal information are being input into a database? This is not just paranoia. A five-year, $200 million program is now being coordinated at the Pentagon to develop a database called Total Information Awareness, which will compile personal data on all of us, including travel and telephone records, email messages, and credit card purchases. And finally, the effects of a war in Iraq can and will be used to justify the outlawing of strike action, one of the most powerful weapons that union workers have. Just about any potential strike can be painted with the brush of anti-patriotic activity, and it will be. What does this mean for unions? We must educate ourselves and our members, and we must not limit ourselves to what have been historically union issues. We must encourage each other to speak freely and address all the consequences of a war on Iraq. Private sector unions must stand up in support of the public sector. We must support our immigrant brothers and sisters in the workforce. International issues such as the war and such as globalization have a direct impact on the self-interest of our membership. Many of the consequences of the war will severely challenge the labor movement's ability to build solidarity, but we must keep on building solidarity. The alternative is to go back into hiding behind individual and to hiding from collective action.
Rebecca Hanscom of Teamster Local 738 in Chicago, Illinois, thanks to Wayne Himbach of Labor Express for that piece. San Francisco Weekly columnist Matt Smith has been concerned about the dawning of a new America. That's America spelled with a K. And so he recently took some action of his own to find out what federal information czar John Poindexter is up to these days. Poindexter is the former Iran-Contra conspirator, and he's been named head of the new federal division to compile data on would-be terrorists. Smith wrote a column which in many ways Poindextered Poindexter. We asked him exactly what Poindexter is supposed to be accomplishing with his new position.
As I understand it, for purposes of running some kind of ill-defined, described algorithms detecting patterns in massive amounts of data that they're supposedly going to create and store on us, they'll be able to tease out activities or patterns of behavior that might belong to terrorists. But what was interesting about this project to my readers, and I guess probably your listeners as well, is just this amalgamation by the government of every single piece of information that ever is generated on us, whether from shopping or using a cell phone or registering for a driver's license. And the people that responded to my column most enthusiastically were online types, wired types, internet types that have been following the issue of privacy in the internet for a long time, because they've been following all these new technologies that are supposedly going to keep an even closer track on what we're doing with ourselves every the minute of the day, whether it's cell phones that can open car and home doors, or you know, all the internet information that's generated from our surfing on the internet, or you know, all these new generation technologies that are going to be able to keep close track on us. So that's what they were worried about, is that the government would be using this sort of thing.
So now, you being the resourceful Californian that you are, you didn't just sit around and bite your nails. You kind of let your fingers do the walking, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I write the city column for SF Weekly, and as part of my weekly mission to keep the wolves at bay, that's to say, get a column out. A friend of mine had just run across the fact that what seemed to be Poindexter's phone number and homeowner information and other types of information that was on various databases was pretty easily available on the internet, and so the next leap was obviously, well, he's using this kind of information in ways that scare people. What would happen if people did a sort of through the Looking Glass Total Information Awareness Project, and rather than detecting patterns in data on the activity of terrorists, how about looking for patterns in Poindexter's personal life? And so it's sort of a humor column. At the moment that I wrote the initial column, it was more as a work of irony, suggested, well, let's all band together and do this.
You put out a call for action, too, didn't you?
Call for action. It was a facetious call for action, but as it turned out, people that do a lot of thinking and have a lot of interest in the issues of technology, information, security, and politics took it really seriously. And by the next day, within 2 days, it was posted on about 125 websites.
Now, when you say it, what are you referring to?
The Poindexter's phone number and a few other things, and a suggestion that if he's going to use this data or compile it in a way that makes people uncomfortable, why not use data against him? Call him at home.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to your column, you have his home phone number,
his address,
the sighting on his house, information about that.
Yeah, that's just from the internet, easy to find stuff.
You were able to find out all of that on the internet.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an unlisted number?
Well, I think now he does. I didn't call it subsequently, but a number of people emailed to say that line had been shut off. So I suspect he now has it. I mean, internet phone directories carry old versions of phone numbers that have subsequently been unlisted on, as I understand it, so I don't follow this very closely. As I was explained to me, you can get more telephone numbers off of internet phone databases than you can out of phone books or information dialing 411, and so this was on Yahoo White Pages.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying you never called the number?
I called the number, yeah. I spoke to Linda Poindexter.
His wife?
Yeah.
What happened?
I asked if it was the home of Admiral John Poindexter. She said it was, but it wasn't there right now. I asked who I was, what I wanted. I said I just wanted to speak to him about information awareness. He says, well, I'm on another line right now. Can you get back to me? And subsequently, I left messages and wasn't able to get a hold of him. But other people evidently did that wrote to me evidently did get through. One fellow had a extended conversation with Linda, kind of arguing the merits of total information awareness. It was kind of funny. Yeah, ironically, perhaps right after I finished the column, I read that Bill Clinton was up at UC Davis giving a talk, which is a state university about an hour north of San Francisco here, endorsing total information awareness.
Bill Clinton was?
Yes. Yes, so, and, you know, I couched things.
What does he have to lose at this point?
Well, his analysis was that it's foolish that companies have all this information that could have telling bits that would have exposed the hijacker terrorists, but the government and people looking for terrorists hasn't accessed that information, and that's what he said at this speech. So, you know, I was couching it as part of this whole era of a really aggressive right wing government. And then what do you know? Soon afterward, I learned that Bill Clinton is around that same time giving a speech endorsing this project.
San Francisco Weekly columnist Matt Smith. As the International Weapons Inspection Team continues its work in Iraq, Sonali Kalhatar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke with Jacqueline Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation. Cabasso recently led a citizens weapons inspection team to the gates of the U.S. Nuclear Weapons Laboratory in Livermore, California. The lab is suspected of secretly working on nuclear weapons and bioterrorism research. Cabasso's group wants the U.S. to accept inspections of its own nuclear weapons facilities under the same conditions as mandated to Iraq.
It was very effective in terms of demonstrating that what's the United States' attitude, that it arrogates to itself the right to maintain an enormous nuclear weapons establishment, to continue to modernize its nuclear weapons, to make them more militarily usable, and at the same time to threaten any other state that even thinks about acquiring nuclear weapons, even using the same rationale that the United States uses to protect its national security, to threaten that country with nuclear use. The United States has turned the notion of nonproliferation completely on its head and is now threatening to use nuclear weapons to prevent other countries from acquiring nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, or biological weapons. And what we're saying is that what the citizen weapons inspectors are saying is that we welcome the return of the inspectors to Iraq, and we call for all states that are either known or suspected of having nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction, including the United States, to accept inspections of their own facilities on the same terms. In other words, what's good for the goose is what's good for the gander. And the only way that we are going to move towards a safer, less contentious, more just world is for everybody to get rid of their nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons as a step on the road to getting rid of all of their military security doctrines. The threat of the use of nuclear weapons now and possibly chemical and biological weapons is perhaps as great as it has ever been, and we've got to make a choice. We're either going to pursue this policy of total global domination through the threat of overwhelming military force, and other countries are going to adopt that same model to defend their national security, or we're going to move towards a new kind of security paradigm based on multilateral cooperative efforts to provide everybody with enough food to eat, health care, and so on and so forth, a kind of security model based on human and ecological security that applies to everybody.
You were talking about some of these issues and using the word hypocrisy so much because its sense is that weapons of mass destruction are going to be used by the United States, or they're promising to use weapons of mass destruction in order to deter weapons of mass destruction. It's interesting the use of language here. Our weapons are never called weapons of mass destruction. Our weapons are always in the context of deterrence.
That's correct. I sometimes feel that members of the Bush administration are channeling George Orwell, in their use of language. But it's just absurd. Nuclear weapons are inherently weapons of mass destruction. If threatening to use nuclear weapons is a criteria, then the United States has to be the most dangerous country on Earth because it is the only country that has actually used nuclear weapons. And I want to point out that the United States is maintaining a permanent arsenal of over 10,000 nuclear weapons, is actively engaged in modifying all of the nuclear weapons in its existing stockpile, that is, all of the weapons types, in some cases to give them new and enhanced military capabilities and to extend their shelf lives. It's also engaged in research now on new weapons concepts designed to make nuclear weapons more usable. They're studying a robust nuclear earth penetrator now, which was a concept that emerged after the first Gulf War to, quote-unquote, get Saddam in his bunker, and is also being talked about in terms of destroying any hidden underground chemical or biological weapons facilities or command and control bunkers, that sort of thing. So the United States is aggressively moving forward with its own weapons of mass destruction program. And I really think that we have to point out that nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons are not equal. They're not equal in their destructive capability. It's generally recognized that nuclear weapons are still in a category by themselves in terms of their overwhelming destructive power, which is something that we don't talk about very much. But a single nuclear weapon, a single modern nuclear weapon of a typical type that's in the U.S. arsenal, depending on where it was used, could actually kill millions of people, one bomb. So we are talking about a scale of potential devastation that is impossible for us to really imagine. And we forget that. So when we're talking about deterrence and dissuasion, we are talking about a holocaust of potentially unprecedented proportions. And it's particularly dangerous to be talking about the use of these weapons now in the region of the world that we're discussing. Because if you look at the region where Iraq is situated, many of the countries surrounding Iraq have chemical or biological weapons. This is something that is conveniently not being discussed now. And of course, Israel has a large, sophisticated nuclear arsenal. India and Pakistan are not far away and are continuing to engage in a nuclear standoff, which is also often forgotten in the current conflict. So we have a situation where any unilateral military action, particularly by the United States, could set off a chain of events that it's hard to exactly predict in its specificity, but which could very quickly escalate into a cycle of violence and use of these chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons that we have never seen before. So we are really talking about a recipe for disaster unless the international community gets itself together and challenges the big bully, to use plain language.
Jacqueline Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation. She recently led a citizens' weapons inspection team to the gates of the U.S. Nuclear Weapons Laboratory in Livermore, California. Finally, we conclude a two-part interview with songwriter, activist, and guitarist Jim Page, who has been carrying on the traditions of Woody Guthrie. His special brand of activism resounds in coffee houses and on campuses around the country, and he shares his views on war and peace.
Patriotism, to me, is based on the idea that you're proud of who you are and where you're from, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when it becomes belligerent so that who you are and where you're from is better than who they are and where they're from, we have problems. And when it begins to arm itself and act aggressively on those principles, we have bigger problems. You know, I mean, I was never into school spirit or any of that stuff because I couldn't see why my school would be better than the other kids' school. It didn't feel right. I don't want to dislike these people or feel superior to them. I don't even know them. So to me, this stuff is all really kind of weird to begin with.
So you didn't get into the school spirit, Jim? Is that what you're saying?
No, it doesn't make sense to me. I had a lot of friends in school. There are people I still see after all these years. But it doesn't mean that my friends at my school are better than their friends in their school. And I think we need to be able to be happy about who we are without needing to feel superior. I think we need to stop feeling superior. I don't think there needs to be a greatest country in the world. I don't think there needs to be a superpower. I don't think anybody should have veto power. I think there should be an international court, criminal court, and I think certain people should be brought to justice before that court. Some of them might be Americans. Who knows? What's the problem? This, you know, it's just, this is a big country. It's a young country. There's a lot of stuff we haven't learned. There's a lot of things we've done that we haven't admitted. Relax. You know, I didn't write the Constitution. You didn't. I didn't give out the smallpox blankets. You didn't do that. Nobody alive today did these things. So relax. Let's bring it all on the table and look at it. Change the course while we still can and take these mad people out of their positions of power, or at least keep the power away from them until we can get somebody else in there that isn't so full of themselves. I mean, this is crazy.
You said smallpox blankets, and I'm assuming that's a reference to Native Americans.
Yeah.
We do, however, see headlines today whereby the Bush administration has decided that it's going to be administering smallpox vaccines to military personnel and emergency recruiters just in the event that there is a smallpox attack on the U.S. by a terrorist.
Well, I mean, every once in a while, they have to give us another fear. It's like, you know, when there was a vague threat, and the people that told us, this Ashcroft or whoever, said, well, we can't be specific about the source or the specificness of the threat, but it concerned all of the major bridges in California. Okay, so all of these, you know, National Guard troops went out there, and everybody went on alert, and the Pentagon was ratcheted up another couple of notches, and Bush got his standing back again, and they need to keep doing this. I mean, I don't know if they have smallpox. I seriously doubt, from everything I've read and understood, from Scott Ritter's book to, you know, what the other inspectors are saying, Iraq doesn't have very much. Okay, what they do have, these things, these biological weapons, they degrade. Whatever they may have, if they may have little bits here and there, have degraded so that they're basically useless. But if we can be scared every 6 months or 2 months or whatever is necessary to keep us, you know, saying, here, take more rights away, invade my privacy, tap my phone, read my emails, follow me to work, come into my house when I'm gone and go through everything, please, save me from these terrorists. To me, it looks like a scare tactic.
You loved your sweet country for all of your life, like your mother and father before you. And the land runs deep, so deep in your blood, your flesh and your bone and your sinews. Descendants and ancestors deep as it goes, a relative circle as far as your eye. It can all be undone in the flash of an instant. Mechanical thunder that bruises the sky, bruises the sky. Goodbye to my relatives all of my life. Never again will I see. You won't have a name when they fly the big airplanes. Collateral damage is all you will be, all you will be. From a faraway place where the language is strange, they come with their angry machines. And the clouds rain a metal that hurts when it falls, and it shatters the ground, making everything scream. And the children run crippled, the old people hide. The babies are caught in the rebel debris. But the strangers don't know you, you are only a number. Underreported on color TV, goodbye to my relatives all of my life, never again will I see. You won't have a name when you hear the big airplanes, collateral damage is all you will be, all you will be.
Jim Page, songwriter, activist, guitarist, from his CD Collateral Damage. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Madil Hamad of KPFA, Hakam Takash, Ingrid Drake, Matt Bradley, Bintake Brooklyn, and Marcus Tyler Brown. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Goodbye to my relatives all of my life. Never again will I see. You won't have a name when they fly the big airplanes. Collateral damage is all you will be.